Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
So we recently reported on how the U.S. Supreme Court is near decisions on the use of affirmative action at colleges and universities, something U.S. businesses are watching very closely. So by the end of this month, I mean, there's only a few days left, Matt, legal experts predict that the U.S. Supreme Court will ban race-based admissions in higher education. You and I have talked about this.
Yeah, we have. And, you know, it's a very interesting and controversial issue, right? Because a lot of people are for it and they think we need affirmative action to make strides that we clearly haven't yet by market means. And there are those who say this is just using discrimination to reverse the ills of discrimination. So,
yeah. And Business Week did actually talk to different individuals about it. And some said, yep, I definitely benefited. Some said, you know what? I don't think it's a good thing. And these are people who, you know, had access to affirmative action programs that actually did something for them. So I'm curious what our next guest has to say and how it kind of plays into the financial arena. Let's head to Oakland, California, where we find Illumin Capital Managing Partner Darren Dotson on Zoom from Oakland. Darren, nice to have you back with us. I do want to start with those Supreme Court decisions because it does feel like there's a wave making its way through the country. What do you think about this? Because companies are watching too, because they are caught in the crossfire of all of this. There are initiatives that they put into place, and yet you see kind of from a legal perspective, the winds are changing.
Yeah, thanks. It's great. It's great to be back. And what I would say is that from our standpoint at Illumin Capital, a lot of the elements that we're looking at in terms of the waves of change within the country result back to the asset management business and the fact that only 1.4% of $82 trillion in capital are managed by women and people of color. So we think that that's well below.
Darren, repeat that stat because I think a lot of people will be like, what? That sounds crazy, but it's true.
It's true.
So say it again.
1.4% of $82 trillion in capital managed by women and people of color. And, you know, there's, if, for those of us that love statistical analysis and market-based strategies, that's in the context of massive growing and multi-trillion dollar Black and Latinx buying power in the United States. And we've seen that there's an incredible opportunity to invest in companies. And that one strange thing that we found in our research with Stanford was that the higher Black managers perform, the less capital they get. People are more willing to leave money on the table the higher they perform. So I think there's some real deep analysis needed.
What's up with that? Is the world just racist?
You know, I think that within the biases that asset allocators sign up for their fiduciary duty, but biases keep them from fulfilling their fiduciary duty to make the most money for their clients. And in this case, going past high-performing Black fund managers to invest in people that are familiar is a violation of their fiduciary duty, which is another legal requirement that those that manage money are supposed to live up to every day. And it happens if they don't work on these biases towards Black people, women, Latinx people, then they're really not serving their investors in ways that they're signing up legally to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll never forget a phrase that Marcus Shaw on this program shared with us. You need to let your greed overcome your bias. His point was that, you know, if you increase diversity, you're going to be able to increase your revenue and your profits as well. Let's talk about building back Black Wall Street, the revitalization of Black Wall Street, as opposed to starting a new one. Black Wall Street, black banks, this is something that at one point had a lot of momentum and was destroyed.
Yes. In terms of building Black Wall Streets more generally, there were a number of thriving communities across the country that were wealthy Black communities that were targeted with either interventions that were government-focused interventions in terms of building highways through communities, or targeted by racial violence, like in Tulsa a little more than 100 years ago. But I think what I'd like to share is the idea of Black Wall Street as an idea and the tearing down of Black Wall Street as an idea, because I think that it's too easy to forget that those that built Wall Street were literally enslaved Black folks, that New York, Boston, and other areas of the country benefited from the financial system of slavery over time. And as we look at what Wall Street can do, we look at that stark number of 1.4% of $82 trillion in capital, despite women and people of color making up, you know, half of the country, and significant amounts of the, and growing amounts of the country. And we have to ask the question, why isn't the statistical probability that women and Black people would be represented in the leadership of the asset management business or ownership sort of represented as it might be statistically? So that's part of the questions that we ask with our research partners at Stanford Spark, who are some of the top folks in the world in social psychology, professors at Stanford, and those that are running with many firms around the country statistical analysis on portfolio construction.
So Matt and I have talked about this a lot, and it's above and beyond the right thing to do. And I just, but sometimes, you know,
increasing gender and racial diversity.
Correct. But returns often speak volumes. And what can you share with us about pursuing this type of investing and what you guys are doing and what kind of returns you get for your investors?
Yeah, what I'd say from a return perspective is that, you know, and this isn't new information. In fact, Dr. Lisa Cook, the only Black woman in the 108-year history of the Federal Reserve Board, her area of research as a professor is on terror and Black value creation. She studies patents in Black communities and equates the 1,100 lost patents because of racial terror between 1900 and roughly 2010 as the value of a small European economy and lost GDP. So I think the real message here is that so many in the asset management business are missing such value in a system that is pushing people away that could equate to returns or increased value in the magnitude of a small European country boost to the GDP, which certainly as inflation increases and we have lots of different challenges around interest rates in the United States could be a large benefit to lift all boats.
So what do you do, Darren, on the ground in order to increase gender and racial diversity?
Oh, we partner with the funds that we work with over a 10-year period, and we focus on giving them the tools to address bias within their hiring, promotion, retention, and attraction of talent processes, within their board selection processes, and then within their investment decision-making processes. And what we want them to do is find the best people in the world. I think to us, that includes women and people of color, whereas to much of the financial markets, often high performing or better performing women, people of color are left out of the conversation when it comes to hiring, which again, results in 1.4% of $82 trillion in capital managed by women and people of color collectively. So something is going on beyond looking at financial decision-making is certainly our thesis.
Well, it's so good to check in with you once again and look forward to doing so in the future. Darren, thank you so much and hearing about the work you guys are doing. Darren Dotson, Managing Partner at Illumina Capital on Zoom from Oakland, California. Oakland, its own city with, you know, revitalization going through a lot and coming around.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is interesting to see people like Darren who are investing in this and trying to make a difference with the money that they put into the market. You know, we talk with so many people who come on here with studies and the results
right.
of studies, and
he's
we know that things are bad and need to be changed, and he's actually putting his money where his mouth is there.
No, exactly, and can see the payoff, and certainly in terms of increasing and creating communities.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Top of mind continues to be what's going on inside Russia. We've talked about it from a couple different angles, and we know President Vladimir Putin spoke for about 6 minutes, a very short address to his nation, condemning leaders of the Wagner mercenary group as traitors to Russia in a late-night speech to his nation. Those were his first public comments since the mutiny that posed the most serious threat to his nearly quarter century rule. So let's get to it. A little bit more analysis. Andy Brown is partner at Brunswick Group, former editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy. He spent 3 decades in Asia as both China editor and a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Today, he leads the China Hub as a partner at Brunswick Group. And he is joining us on Zoom in New York City. Andy, good to have you here. Also with us is Mick Mulroy, co-founder of the Lobo Institute. They advise, consult, teach on current and future conflicts and how to end them and really how to prevent them from happening again in the future. Andy is, Mick is on Zoom, on the phone, from Montana. I'll get my Zooms and phones right. Andy, Mick, thank you for being with Matt and me. I'm curious, Andy, what kind of calls you are getting specifically on what's going on in Russia?
Well, it's great to be here, Carol, Matt. The hot off the press, Putin has come out with angry comments, calling Prigozhin and his mutineers traitors, and saying that the whole of Russian society has rallied against them, and saying that they only made their move to cover up battlefield failures in Ukraine, all of which, of course, is complete nonsense. Demonstrated such by television pictures that Russians, indeed the whole world, saw over the weekend, where we saw Wagner fighters being enthusiastically received in Rostov, and almost no opposition, as several of his columns swept north to within almost 100 miles of the gates of Moscow.
Yeah, I mean, they were lined up to take selfies with Prigozhin. Clearly,
right.
This guy has serious support in Russia, at least in the areas that he occupied. Mick Mulvaney, let me bring you in. Mick Mulroy, let me bring you into this and ask you.
I know, that was a flash in the past. Well, not so far. I know. Yeah.
So Mick Mulroy, a very different person than Mick
Mulvaney.
Let me ask you your take on this in terms of how does Putin do without the Wagner Group? They're responsible for pretty much everything that the Russians have gotten right in Ukraine, you know, from their perspective. If it were just up to the Russian army, you know, Ukraine may have pushed them out already. So can he do without them?
So great to be with you guys, and certainly a lot going on today. That is a good question, because from President Putin's speech, two things really stuck out to me. One, he acknowledged that they were a colossal threat, something that most totalitarian regimes don't like to admit. And two, he didn't really have any of the concessions that we thought he might based on whatever deal he made with Prigozhin. He did not announce that he would remove the Minister of Defense, Shoigu, or the Chief of Staff, Gerasimov. And he did reiterate that he wants Wagner, or he insists that Wagner either lay down their arms or join the MOD. That is good for Ukraine and all those that support him. It is not necessarily good for Russian efforts in Ukraine, because although it's composed mostly of war criminals, quite frankly, they are one of the few Russian forces that is willing to go on the offensive and has taken some of the more key terrain that Russians have taken within the last 6 months. So that is going to be to be determined, just what the fate of Prigozhin and the Wagner Group is at the end of this.
So clearly Putin has to do something to sort of re-cement his place in power. A lot of people are saying Prigozhin doesn't have long to live. But on the other hand, Prigozhin seems to be in a pretty good place, specifically if he goes, rather than to Belarus, back to Rostov, which is a key way to maintain his leverage, right? It's the logistics hub for the fight in Ukraine that he's already shown he can occupy. What do you think his next move is?
So that's a good question. I do think he should be looking over his shoulders and probably having somebody taste his soup before he does. He has definitely provoked the Russian establishment all the way to the top. Whether he is essentially under guardianship in Belarus is to be determined. But another factor to consider is the Wagner Group obviously operates in more places than Ukraine. They are throughout Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa. And they make quite a lot of money, and I would assume the regime gets a portion of that. I don't know, but I would assume that is in direct cooperation with the regime. So it might be that he is precluded from potentially leaving Belarus for operating in Ukraine, but they might want him to keep his operations going in Central African Republic and now in Sudan and Libya and other places where they not only operate, but they operate potentially at a profit.
Incredibly profitably. Actually, Mick, that brings up a question I want to throw to Andy. If Prigozhin is making, reportedly he's making over $1 billion in, you know, just a few properties in Africa. I mean, the grand total may be much more than that. But he can't put that in a U.S. bank or even keep it offshore anymore. What does a Russian criminal who, you know, isn't allowed to move around financially in the Western world do with his wealth? Does he have to, you know, kiss the ring of Vladimir Putin? Can he bring it to China? Can he bring it to India?
First of all, I think he's interested, probably right now, more concerned about his life rather than preserving his wealth. He's a marked man. He has punctured Putin's aura of invincibility. Putin is no longer the strong man that he once was, and everybody can see that. Here you have Prigozhin, who's challenged the Kremlin, and he's not exactly got off scot-free, but Putin appears over the weekend to have sort of let him off the hook. We don't know where he is. He may or may not be in Belarus. Certainly the deal was brokered by Lukashenko. And we don't actually know what the status quo is of his heavily armed, battle-hardened Wagner forces. They certainly haven't demobilized. In fact, all of the reports that I've been reading out of Russia today is that his recruitment centers across the country are still operating normally. So the reason that Prigozhin gave for launching the mutiny was that he said that the Russian military wanted to disband the Wagner forces. Clearly, that has not happened.
Andy, our Bloomberg Big Take, which is our story that our editorial team deems that the world should read on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com, but it talks about the Russian president and basically facing this historic threat to his absolute grip on power in Russia. Do you think his years or his term is coming to an end as a result of this?
You know, it's hard to predict where this is going to go. These are early days and everything is very confused right now. But certainly, as I say, his aura of power has been badly damaged. Let's see what happens to Prigozhin. The other very interesting thing about the weekend, contrary to what Putin said about the whole country rallying against him, when this thing first started, and remember, we didn't know then if it was a mutiny, whether it was a coup, and nobody in Russia knew that either. And the Russian elites, the ones that are closest to Putin, failed to speak up for him. They held their silence. Mm. They were waiting to see very clearly which way the winds were going to blow, whether the mutiny, as it was back then, a coup, as it seemed to be, would be successful or not. So Putin has clearly lost a lot of his support, or at least perceptions of support in parts of Russian society and the security forces that really matter.
Mick, you agree in terms of President Putin's standing in his country?
Yes, I do. I would add also that it's become very clear that his decision to invade Ukraine was a significant strategic mistake. And you have Prigozhin, one of the main fighters there, acknowledging, and he can't unring that bell, that the Russian people were lied to. There was no NATO expansion. There is now, but there wasn't before. And that there was no threat to ethnic Russians in Ukraine. He already said that. And I think the Russian people are going to hear that, and they're going to hear it more often. And I think that and the fact that Russia is, in effect, losing what they wanted to do in Ukraine. And most dictators cannot survive a loss like that, and certainly when he looks as weak as he does, acknowledging that this was a colossal, quote, colossal threat to him from the Wagner group.
Yeah, certainly you'd think that Russian mothers will consider Prigozhin's word when they hear that their sons have died, and how many, you know, now I think more than a couple hundred thousand Russians have died in Ukraine. Mick, you know, from your years at the CIA, from your years at the Department of Defense, what do you think we're hoping for? What do you think America's hoping for in terms of a coup? Because it seemed on Friday like, oh, coup, that would be great. We want Putin out of power. But it seemed now like, well, we definitely don't want Prigozhin in power. So
right, what's the alternative?
Who else is out there that could challenge Vladimir Putin?
So to start with, I do not think, and I don't know, I'm out of government, but I do not think the U.S. had anything to do with this. I don't see a logical reason why they would want to replace, you know, Vladimir Putin with Prigozhin. Prigozhin has actively called for the use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine in the past, and he's quite frankly very unstable. So I don't see, like, I would agree with the White House position that they would not have any reason to promote that. Who would be a suitable alternative to Putin? I don't know right now, but I guarantee you the intelligence community is assessing just that and trying to find out who may, not that we would push for any of them because we're not, our policy is not regime change in Russia, but to be able to get ahead of anybody who may potentially take a run at Putin. I just don't know who that person would be.
Andy, come on in on this if you have any thoughts about who might take over for Putin. But I also want to throw China into this. This is something, you know so much about China and how they lead. We've kind of laughed, but not laughed, a little bit about the Chinese foreign ministry coming out with a statement describing the weekend's events in Russia as Moscow's internal affair, something they often say about their own internal affairs. But how do you think about the role of China and what happens here in Russia specifically? What do we kind of need to kind of have top of mind here?
Well, I think that the Chinese are looking at this with a mixture of alarm, but also a certain amount of smug self-satisfaction. And the alarm because they're worried, they're concerned that they have made a very bad bet on Vladimir Putin. Putin is Xi Jinping's quote-unquote best friend. They've met 40-odd times. And, you know, they're quite similar figures in a way. They both promote a resentful form of nationalism. They are both on a mission to revive the historic glories of their respective countries, and they believe that the United States stands in the way. And they formed an axis, an East-West axis to push back against U.S. power and to revise the U.S.-led global order. And the anchor of that Western axis of Vladimir Putin is looking decidedly shaky right now. And the project to push back against U.S. power is becoming bogged down in the blood-soaked battlefields of Ukraine. Smug self-satisfaction, because I think Xi Jinping is looking at this and saying, this would never happen in China. We would never, I would never allow control of China to slip away in this way. In fact, the first thing that Xi Jinping did when he came to power in 2013 was a purge in the military. And he put his own loyalists in charge.
Well, so happy to have the two of you here. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Andy Brown, partner over at Brunswick Group. Mick Mulroy, co-founder of Lobo Institute. Really smart and insight and coming at it from a couple different angles there. We so appreciate it. Be well to both of you.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.